When Frankfurter said that as judges we are neither Jew nor Gentile, neither Catholic nor agnostic, he was using the language of religion, and a reference to St. Paul, to say that attachment to the Constitution was his overarching religious commitment. All religions put their adherence to the test and require sacrifice. Frankfurter's constitutional religion demanded that a judge reach results that contradict his political preferences. Only then could he be certain that his allegiance was to the Constitution, not the false idols of partisanship. Disinterest could be proven only by way of sacrifice, the sacrifice of voting against one's political preferences. To Frankfurter, Holmes personified judicial disinterest. But Holmes's disinterest derived from world-weary acceptance of the inevitable victory of whatever social forces were destined to prevail. If in the long run, he once wrote, beliefs in proletarian dictatorship are destined to be accepted by the dominant forces of the community, the only meaning of free speech is that they should be given their chance and have their way. From this, it followed that the judge's job was to stand by and allow social processes to run their course. If the people want to go to hell, I will help them, Holmes liked to say. It's my job. By contrast, Frankfurter's judicial restraint was driven by a deeply romantic conception of the nature and tendencies of the American people living under conditions of democracy. For Frankfurter, the most astonishing fact about the United States was the liberalism of its people. A liberalism manifested not simply in the public's embrace of progressive ideals, but also in toleration and a commitment to basic rights. His deep loyalty to the country that had taken him as an immigrant led him to downplay the racism, prejudice, and other types of illiberalism that could be found in America. Frankfurter worried that assigning to the Supreme Court the job of protecting liberal rights would relieve the public of the responsibility to protect basic rights on its own, through influencing the legislature. If the courts should become the institution charged with protecting rights, he feared, the public would cease to care about protecting rights itself. Legislators might enact laws that they knew to be unconstitutional, passing the buck to the courts in the expectation they would strike those laws down. What was more, the courts might eventually lose their legitimacy, since they would be seen as acting against the public, not in fulfillment of its most deeply held values. The right thing to do, therefore, under our basic constitutional structure, was to rely on the democratic polity to preserve rights, not for the courts to intervene. In his dissent in the Second Flag Salute case, Frankfurter laid out this argument for judicial restraint as explicitly as he ever would again in his career. Ultimately, Frankfurter's loyalty to the American people, as he imagined them to be, trumped the concern he had for the Jehovah's Witnesses, whose loyalty was being impugned, just as it trumped any concern he might have had for Schneiderman. Frankfurter preferred to wait for the historical moment to pass and for the public to realize the error of its ways. To the extent he believed that loyalty to American values was itself a condition of liberalism, he may even have felt that the witnesses' children would be better served by saluting the flag than by abstaining from that ritual. The alternative, he feared, was for the courts to assume a new role, one that he had rejected when his political views were not those of the majority of the court. Loyalty to Frankfurter's distinctive vision of the Constitution was the transcendent principle for him here, and his sacrifice was proof of that loyalty above all else. Chapter 25, Internment. Late on the evening of March 28, 1942, Minoru Yasui, a 26-year-old lawyer from Portland, Oregon, went for a walk, in the hopes of getting arrested. He passed a policeman, but instead of arresting him, the officer told him, "Run along home, sonny boy, or you'll get in trouble." So at 11 p.m., Yasui presented himself at his neighborhood police station and demanded to be booked. The desk sergeant obliged. The fact that he had walked in was proof enough of his crime. Yasui had been born on an apple and asparagus farm in Hood River, Oregon, and lived in the state most of his life. He had earned his undergraduate and law degrees from the University of Oregon in Eugene, where he had also been enrolled as a candidate in the Reserve Officers Training Corps. On graduation in 1937, he had been commissioned as a second lieutenant in the Army Reserve. But Yasui was a Japanese American. although he was a citizen of the United States and had been his whole life, it was illegal for him to be out of his house after dark, by order of Lieutenant General John DeWitt, Commander of Western Defense. Violation of the order was a federal crime. Yasui was soon joined in his goal of testing the curfew law by another Japanese-American, Gordon Hirabayashi of Seattle, a Christian pacifist who voluntarily turned himself in to the FBI. The curfew, it turned out, was only the beginning. In the weeks that followed, the Army's West Coast curfew against people of Japanese origin was transformed into a full-on program of expulsion and detention. Some 120,000 ethnic Japanese, most of them U.S. citizens, were ordered to report at dawn to detention points with just a few of their possessions. Luggage was labeled and piled for shipping. Sometimes local churches or the Red Cross would provide coffee and donuts. Then the Japanese Americans were put onto trains or buses to assembly centers. One recalled seeing a young man saying goodbye to his girlfriend who was being boarded onto a train. An MP guard shoved him away from the train as the train tooted its whistle. The man ran to the other side of the train to kiss her once more. The MP cocked his shotgun and ran after him. When the MP reached the young man, he clubbed him with his rifle butt. The young man was taken away with blood running down his face. From the assembly centers, the Japanese Americans were sent to one of 10 relocation centers, temporary military-style camps, located hundreds of miles inland, mostly in the western desert. From 1942 until 1945, these Americans lived in tin shacks behind barbed wire. Conditions were terrible, with little running water, less privacy, and minimal food. Whole families crowded into tiny spaces. Sand from the frequent sandstorms poured through cracks in the walls, coating everything with fine dust. Temperatures went below zero in the winter evenings and over 100 degrees in the summer days. Meanwhile, the internees' businesses were shuttered and their farms lay fallow, unless purchased at deep discounts by white neighbors. The overwhelming majority of Japanese Americans peacefully obeyed the deportation orders. A few followed the example of Yasui and Hirabayashi and challenged the law. The only woman among them, Mitsuye Endo, was a stenographer working for the California Department of Motor Vehicles in Sacramento. Contemporary photographs show her in a shirt dress at her typewriter, her hair pin-curled and rolled back to her shoulders in the classic 1940s style. Her brother was serving in the U.S. Army. After Pearl Harbor, Endo was dismissed from her job because of her Japanese ancestry. Then, when she was sent to the Tule Lake War Relocation Center near the Oregon border, she brought a lawsuit demanding to be released.